Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting through our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you. As always, we begin our program with ways to empower, be healthy, and live a longer and happier life. Health benefits from being outdoors, and food companies are hiding harmful high-fructose corn syrup under a new name. I'll share that with you as well. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the environment. I want to share some new information with you on that. And I'm going to do a commentary from Professor Henry Giroux on our war culture. I'm going to have a guest newsmaker on early in the program. Our regular guest will be Lewis Lapham. Now, he will be a part of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, How America Has Abandoned Its Democracy. Never heard of Lewis Lapham? He's an American legend as a historian, essayist, and writer. He is the editor emeritus for Harper's Magazine and founder of the Lapham's Quarterly. So he's a heavyweight. You're going to enjoy that conversation. But before him, we'll be having on Dr. Garth Porter. We're going to talk about the newsmaker on Syria and Aleppo. If you watched the major media, all of it, over the last week, it shows you that the enemy in Syria is Russia and Syrian army. And it tells you about the executions, all forms of violence against innocent civilians. Makes it seem really bad to be in East Aleppo when the government's trying to take back the area. However, last night, I decided to go across all the major social media and look at actual individuals in Aleppo coming out of the buildings now that the enemy is gone. Al-Nusra and ISIS affiliates are gone. They've been beaten. Totally different picture. They're celebrating. They're chanting. They're firing guns in the air. They're happy. And then you see the different people making comments about what it was like under the last 4 years of living in terror and the summer executions. They also talked about all the false setups, the fake news stories coming out of there. So we're going to ask Garth, how is it that we're never told the truth? And yet on the other side, when it comes to, let's say, a city in Iraq that's being liberated, no matter how many dead civilians, it's portraying the Americans and the Iraqi forces as heroes, liberating Mosul. So we want to just show you how corrupt, how biased the American media has become. If time permits, I'll also share some additional insights into fake news, because I've been collecting and inventorying fake news just through the last two presidencies to show you how inundated with fake news we have it. So we have a packed hour. Let's begin. First up, we want to know about broccoli, because broccoli and broccoli sprouts are known to have anti-cancer agents and immune enhancing agents. These are called the indole-3 carbonyls, or for short, I3C, very powerful. This is from University of Illinois. Quote, research that enhances compounds contained in broccoli may lead to a lower risk of coronary heart disease and age-related macular degeneration, according to two new studies that reinforce broccoli's reputation as a superfood. The findings from the Buck Institute in California reveal that boosting the potency of broccoli-related compounds, the indole-3 carbonyl, promotes treatment for the eyes. And meanwhile, University of Illinois researchers have found that the flavonoid accumulation in your blood from broccoli, eating broccoli or broccoli sprouts, These rich flavonoids are associated with a lower risk of coronary heart disease and type 2 diabetes and asthma. So, quote, the findings both sought to increase the health-promoting properties of broccoli, which are already well established. So get your broccoli sprouts. And all they're doing is they're simply crossbreeding different types of broccoli and increasing the phenolic content. But whether you eat the cross-pollinated or the regular broccoli or sprouts, you're getting good, good broccoli into your body. In fact, for people who have cancer or autoimmune disease, like lupus, I always suggest that you have a 2-ounce amount of wheatgrass, 2 ounces of ginger juice, 2 ounces of lemon juice, and 1 ounce of broccoli juice. Mix it all together, dilute all that into a larger 16 ounces of ideally celery, cucumber, and green apple, and drink that down each day. From Leiden University in the Netherlands, when your cholesterol level, especially the bad cholesterol level, the LDL, when it goes up and down, that's not a good thing. And because you're linked to brain dysfunction. And think of the people who go on a diet, they'll lose some weight, they'll start exercising, both of which are good, but then they go off their diet and they stop exercising. They're eating healthy, good, then they stop and go back to old habits, not good. Well, this yo-yo of good and bad, discipline and non-discipline, this not only impacts the cholesterol level, especially the LDL, but it also means that it's going to impact your brain, and that can impact your cognition. So they're finding that colors, words, and things that we have in our cognition are diminished when we have the elevated LDL cholesterol. Not good. So what's the takeaway message here? When you get on a program, stay on it. If it's exercise, stay on it. Just look at it as this for the rest of my life. Eating right, stay on it. And that way your bad cholesterol comes down, the good cholesterol, the HDL, goes up, and you benefit from it. From the University of Frankfurt, a study showing that boosting the immune system can happen if you have cancer with 1 hour of singing a day. And that's very important. Now, it doesn't matter how well you sing. You could even hum. But just the idea that you're focused upon something that gives you pleasure and you're singing it, it impacts the brain, which impacts then feelings of depression and anxiety, which are common symptoms of cancer patients, and then you gain the benefit of an improved immune system. It turns off inflammation. Singing is so relaxing, it turns off inflammation, the body's usual response to disease. So scientists now believe that the effects of singing could also benefit caregivers coping with the illness of a loved one. It strengthens the immune system by reducing your stress. And this was published in the Journal of Behavioral Medicine. And we forget that caregivers have the highest mortality rate, live the shortest lifespans of any group. Now, we don't think about that. Now, add in the fact that you may be caring for a parent who now cannot fully take care of themselves. It's very stressful. And you're not taking care of yourself because maybe you think you don't have the time or you just don't have the energy. That's a negative. You may not be sleeping. In fact, worse, you may actually be working at night. And if you've done that for more than 5 years, you can take 10 years off your life expectancy. So you add all that together and you've got serious problems. So that is important. So again, from the University of Frankfurt, for cancer patients, boost your immune system with 1 hour of singing. Now let's say that you, for some reason, you can't sing for an hour. Do it throughout the day. 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there. Get some of your favorite music on. And if you can't sing, try to create some harmonizing humming. put on some Gregorian chants, put on some flute music, and just so that you are focused upon it and you're in some way expressing it verbally. It's good to do that. I remember the first time as a scientist, as a young scientist, at the Institute of Applied Biology, as the youngest junior scientist, I was very grateful to have met Hans Selye, Dr. Hans Selye, the father of stress therapy. And also, there was a Dr. Lawrence Leshan, who wrote one of America's most popular books on how your emotions impact the outcome of disease. And he was working at the Institute at that time. And I remember I was upstairs on the third floor because I was doing what they called that strange work where I was feeding the rats that they weren't healing downstairs. I was feeding them living foods and sprouts and juices, no boxed or canned food. Everything was fresh, organic, prepared. No cages. They could run free over the whole 3,000 square feet. Natural lighting, little waterfalls I built. And never once got bitten, by the way. Not once in 33 years. And Leshan was downstairs, and I could frequently hear music. And I was just thinking he was using the music in between patients, and I went down one day and was going to invite him to lunch, and lo and behold, he was having people singing and or humming to music they really enjoyed. And I asked him, why are you doing that? And he said, well, it makes people feel better. It reduces their cortisol level, reduces epinephrine, norepinephrine, and adrenaline. It really relaxes them. And he said he was taking people's blood sugar before and after about 20 minutes of singing, and it lowered their blood sugar. So he was advocating it for diabetics. And that was a long time ago. Unfortunately, that never got out there, so it was just one of the little things I learned for myself. And finally, from Harvard School of Public Health, from the Chan School of Public Health, quote, the absence of the negative is not the same thing as the presence of the positive. We found that factors such as optimism, life satisfaction, and happiness are associated with reduced risk of coronary heart disease and other conditions, regardless of such factors as a person's age, socioeconomic status, smoking, or body weight. And that was from the Department of Sociology and Human Development and Health at Harvard. Quote, while most medical and public health efforts today focus on reducing risk factors for disease, evidence has been mounting that enhancing psychological resilience may also make a difference. And so our new findings suggest that we should make efforts to boost optimism, which has been shown to be associated with healthier behaviors and healthier ways of coping with life changes. And the study appears in today's American Journal of Epidemiology. Quote, out of all predictable outcomes of most scientific studies we reviewed, positive thinking was changing longevity of humans more than any other factor. And where I grew up, like where many of you grew up, even if it was a large city, but you still had a small neighborhood, and your home, your friends, your family generally lived within that area. I grew up in a small town in West Virginia. And the one group of people that we all loved were our school teachers. They didn't have to retire when I grew up. And some had taught my father, my older brother, myself. They'd be teaching at 80. And there was a Mrs. Helmick, who was just extraordinary. And she knew who the peer persons who would be acting out and the people who were having trouble and maybe weren't capable of being as diligent in their academic standing. And you would always see her working with them after school. She didn't want anyone to fail. And if you couldn't do that, then you'd come to summer school. But I remember going over to her house. She lived a block away. And she'd sit there on the swing and she'd swing and talk about whatever it was that was important to me at the time. I was just a kid. And the thing I noticed about her and all the other older people is they were happy. They were living an authentic life. Their life was based upon helping other people. Teachers are wonderful in the sense they're sharing energy that allows us, in no small measure, to develop our character and principles and our capacity for critical thinking. Frequently overlooked and underappreciated virtues for us later in life. And there was never anything about, you know, teaching to test. It was teaching to learn. And they also knew who you were outside of the class, so you could always go and talk with them if you had no one else to talk to about an issue. They were always patient. But I just remember everyone who was older that I sat and spoke with, they always had this calmness about it and this joy. They looked forward to the holiday season mainly because of caroling. And everybody went around caroling. And they'd stand outside of people's homes. And they always would find out who was sick, who was going through rough times. And they'd carol a half hour. And I thought, well, that's just terrific. I mean, that's so thoughtful, so kind. And you remember those things. So even today, I appreciate caroling. I appreciate, you know, bringing joy into a season. It's not about buying the gifts. It's about being the gift with your love and your thoughtfulness, caring for others. So when you add that together, and then you put that in with my 5 years intermittent travel around the world, all over the world, to see why were people living longer lives elsewhere than we were here, the one factor that stood out beyond all the things is they had joy as they aged. They had good relationships with their family. They generally lived in nature. They had a cleaner and healthier diet. They never stopped working. They all had hobbies. They lived simple lives. And they were living much longer than their own kin. And one story, I was staying in Naples and Italy, and the family had lived in the mountains. I would later go interview them. The person was very successful in the banking community, in finance community, had one of these, outside, it didn't look like much, but inside it was just a gorgeous apartment, and he was very stressed, and he said, "Man, you have no idea how many times I just wanted to go home. I'm burned out here. I'm stressed. It's taking its toll on my kids, my family. I don't have the quality time for the things I used to find joy in. I don't even have time to take a walk with my wife. When we are together, I'm talking about my problems." He said, "But every time I get a chance, I go home to the mountains in Italy, and it's like stepping back in time where everything slows down. Slow eating, the conversation, the joy of being with people you love." And he said, "And yet I'm addicted to the style, the pace, the comforts of this metropolitan existence." And he was struggling with the idea of, you know, should he give something up? And then they always get this idea, well, sooner or later I'll be successful enough, wealthy enough, happy enough, I can go back to a simpler way of life. It never happens. Yeah, the only time that happens is when you've been struck down by a heart attack or stroke and you dodged a bullet, then suddenly you reprioritize your life. But boy, did I see that everywhere. I still see it now where people in the city, they're so stressed, they don't give themselves a break. They don't get out into nature, except maybe once, twice a year they'll go someplace. You got to bring balance into your life. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come back with a newsmaker. Please stay with us. Backfield in motion. Yeah, I'm going to have to penalize you. Backfield in motion. Yeah. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. Let's go to Northern Virginia. We're standing by as Dr. Garth Porter. Looks like we're lost a connection. Let's see if we can get him back on. If we get him back on, we'll go to him. In the interim, I want to share some additional insights with you. And we're going to go to an audio clip about reality checks. You talk about planting false stories. You talk about what it means to be inundated with propaganda. We're getting it every day. We just got Garth back on, but after Garth, we're going to give you a reality check where the Pentagon is spending $500 million a year to one PR firm to create propaganda videos, propaganda articles, but they don't tell us they're propaganda. And then you come to the conclusion, what good has all this propaganda done? Zero. And that's per year from one agency. Here's dealing with the New York Times. Obama used fake news to sell the Iran deal. Here's what you haven't known until now.
Back in May of this year, the New York Times wrote a long article filled with prose about Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications. He writes Obama's speeches, plans his trips, and runs communication strategy across the White House. He talks to Obama several times a day. So Ben Rhodes is a big part of the White House. The whole article is filled with glamorous stuff about the guy, and then it gets to something really interesting. It gets to the part about how Rhodes was responsible for selling the Iran deal to the American people. One day, the Times writer and Rhodes were hanging out when the news broke about how Iran had just captured two boats with American sailors on them. This was bad for Rhodes, who wanted to sell Americans on Obama's Iran deal. That's his job, selling what the White House does to the people. And the Iran deal was a hard sell. So Rhodes had his work cut out for him, and Iran just did something bad to us. So the writer reports how Rhodes began to spin the story. The article fawns over how Rhodes is able to do this expertly, leaking his spin to news sources he knows will spew it all over the internet, treating his spin like actual fact. And then many words into the article, it actually reveals that Rhodes manufactured the story about a new political reality in Iran to sell to Americans so that they'd support Obama's Iran deal. Rhodes brags about how he created an echo chamber through his news sources, who all kept repeating his story that he made up about how Obama decided to do the deal with Iran because they elected a new moderate. He literally bragged about making up that story and then shuffling it into the echo chamber of what is supposed to be real news coming from the White House. Now, I'm not saying the Iran deal was good or bad. I'm a can't-we-all-just-get-along kind of person myself. And the article does a good job, between all the fawning, of showing just how complicated foreign policy can be. I'm just saying, since we're all talking about fake news these days, it might be worth noting that while everyone is busy upholding old trusted news outlets like the New York Times, I find it interesting that even the Times themselves admit it's pretty much all spin, whether for good or bad. The article supports the point I keep making over and over, and that's this. The conversation shouldn't be about real news or fake news. It should be about the truth. And that is always, always, always somewhere in between.
Okay. Now, so that means that the entire deal with Iran is being handled with lies. We should know what the lies are. We should know the truth. And we should know the consequences. Then let the American public participate in the dialogue. This is from Strategic Cultural Foundation, from Wayne Madsen, who we've had on this program. And it's entitled, "The Major Purveyor of Fake News is the CIA Corporate Complex." I'll just share part of this. The rest of the article is on our website. And by the way, I want to thank all the people who go to our website, download our stories, documentaries, articles, and listen to the broadcasts, because that's how we share it, but share the stories with other people. Quote, "The U.S. corporate media, its strings pulled by the modern version of the Central Intelligence Agency's old Operation Mockingbird media influencing operation, is laughably accusing Russia of generating fake news to influence the outcome of the American presidential election." In a November 24, 2016 article in the CIA Connected Washington Post, reporter Craig Timberg reported, quote, "Russia's increasingly sophisticated propaganda machinery, including thousands of botnets and teams of paid human trolls and networks of websites and social media accounts, echoed and amplified right-wing sites across the internet," and then goes on to talk about how that is what caused the people to not vote for Clinton, but in effect vote for Trump. The Post's article is worthy of the CIA-generated propaganda spun by the paper at the height of the Cold War era called Mockingbird. And by the way, on yesterday's program, I played you a clip from the 1970s where Senator Church was interviewing under oath or questioning under oath the head of the CIA, who said, "Don't you have all these assets working in the media?" Yes. The television, yes. It was network television. Then we had a former news director of CBS saying, "We look forward to it." In fact, once a year they would have meetings of all these journalists from all these respected publications meeting with the CIA to be coached in how to plant stories, fake information. And I gave examples of that as well, like the Gulf of Tonkin, which was fake news. It was fake news that led to real policy, which led to the Vietnam War and over 4 million casualties, including deaths, over 3.2 million of Vietnamese, 58,000 Americans, plus over a million people adversely affected by the war, injured or impacted by post-traumatic stress disorder or Gulf War syndrome, Agent Orange syndrome. So it's no light matter when you destroy the lives of 4 million people by fake news. And that then weapons of mass destruction in 2003, same thing all over again, with millions more displaced, dead, and suffering. But no one ever held accountable. So contrary to what the Post reported about right-wing accounts of Hillary Clinton's ties to a shadowy cabal of global financiers, the vanquished Democratic presidential nominee and her husband, via the slush fund known as the Clinton Foundation, was closely linked to a variety of shadowy global financiers, including those who serve as executives of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. And the Clinton cabal was more at home in the gatherings of secretive syndicates like the Bilderberg Group and Bohemian Club and the Council on Foreign Relations than they were at labor union and student meetings. But maybe I missed something. When was the last time you saw Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, or any of the major politicians or pundits or demagogues showing up where they risked getting arrested for some major and important demonstration? Can you name me one? No, they're not going to, because that's not where they live. That's not who they're thinking about. They're always in these exclusive enclaves. And the Post was clearly fed its poorly sourced, anecdotal-based article on Russia and fake news by the usual suspects, the Russian bashers and the CIA mouthpieces, including the Daily Beast, former U.S. Ambassador to Moscow Michael McFaul, RAND Corporation, George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs, the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia, and a website called propornot.com, and which is linked not only to George Soros funded anti-Russian website, but also to conveyors of CIA disinformation like Snopes.com that you should never trust. The Post article is nothing more than an advertisement for propornot.com, which bills itself as a propaganda identification service. Yeah, you bet. So read the whole article to see how the CIA has no proof. And by the way, no proof. Let me explain so people are fully understanding this. The reason that Clinton lost is because people hate her. They don't trust her. She has shown herself to lie, manipulate. The fact that her husband is charismatic and people like his personality should not in any way take away from the fact of what the Clintons have actually done, including being involved with funding, for example, with arms and technology, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and United Arab Emirates, who in turn have, according to her own leaked emails, supported ISIS and other terrorist groups. She also has met with Turkey and its prime minister, befriending them at the time that we knew, they knew, that Turkey was a major supplier of the oil tankers, over 14,000 oil tankers, that went into Syria, stole its oil, came back into Syria, and through the prime minister's son, divested that in, at $20 a barrel on the market, black market, then went into Iraq and stole its oil, and that money went to ISIS on a daily basis, and they were between $1 to $4 million. And not once, not one single time did the United States, knowing all this was going on and seeing it with their satellites, did it bomb any of those 12 to 14,000 tankers to disrupt the flow. Nor did they stop funding them, nor did they stop the hospitals that were exclusively built on the Turkish border to take in the terrorists and get them back into shape, save their lives, and then arm them again and give them safe passage. So maybe some people who are not as dumb or as affected by disinformation and fake news learn the truth of what our actual policies are in the world, how we befriend terrorist states such as Saudi Arabia that kills gays and women and has no rights and no freedom of religion, no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly, and we're promoting democratic values? No. It's a business transaction. You give us $192 billion, we'll give you weapons and training and intelligence. Oh, and when you go ahead and invade Yemen that has no natural assets, we'll supply all the weapons, the bombs, we'll supply the grenades, we'll supply the airplanes, and the world turns its head as the poorest nation in the Middle East is destroyed and tens of thousands of refugees and people suffering and dying. That's Hillary Clinton. That was Obama. But even more, fake news. Here's some fake news from 1993 to 96. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton advocated for the first genetically engineered food products, BGH. It opened it, and we were told through fake news that this was important. It would save people from starving. That opened the doors for GMOs as substantially equivalent to natural foods. That's fake. Real, it's organic, is not the same as GMO. It's much better. But you weren't told that. The Clintons started the welfare reform policies that ended up diverting funds from welfare programs over to private interests, including private prison systems. But over 1.5 million people who were on welfare and needed that money were then thrown into the streets. They were responsible, and the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act, almost exactly as Newt Gingrich's contract with America that scrapped a lot of aid to families, well, that was spun as something important to help people on welfare. It did just the opposite. They launched, through fake stories, the first major childhood immunization program at the federal level to increase immunization compliance. That was a disaster. They ratified NAFTA, gutting the U.S. manufacturing segment. Millions of jobs lost, and it began the real movement offshore. And that was all sold to us under fake news of how good it would be for the unions and workers. They started Head Start, setting minimal educational standards that has led to the debacle known as standardized testing today. The three strikes and you're in prison for life, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, greatly expanded the war on drugs, particularly in international arena in Colombia, leading to furthering the paramilitary violence there. And kind of ironic when the Clinton, Bill Clinton and his brother were known in Arkansas as major drug users. And Little Rock was a hub of laundering money. And that's a matter of historical record. But you wouldn't know that. And the largest rate of incarceration under any president in American history, quote, lock them up and throw away the key philosophy of Reagan, became legitimized by the Clintons. Approved America's School Act, a continuation of education reform policies that further nationalized a one-model-fits-all educational standard. They ratified GATT, the Religious Freedom in School Act, enabled religious-minded to pray and practice their faith in schools, a bit ambiguous since it opened the doors to the right-wing groups wanting to enforce teaching creationism in the schools. The Effective Death Penalty Act expanded death penalty to 60 additional crimes and assumed capital punishment would remain continuous. The Defense of Marriage Act, the military operations in Yugoslavia and the Balkans and Somalia, all those were based on fake stories. In fact, in Yugoslavia, the International Criminal Trial Court found that Milosevic was innocent. He was not guilty. You didn't see that reported anywhere because we were told the fake stories. He was a demon, he was the devil, but he wasn't. Returned to the Cold War mentality, reneged on the Bush-Gorbachev agreement to expand NATO on Russia's border, which they were never going to do. That was the deal that Bush and Senior and Gorbachev said, keep NATO where it is. They didn't under Clinton. Expanded sanctions on Iraq that caused 500,000 Iraqi children to lose their lives. Now, where was the media creating real stories, telling the truth? Because if you killed 500,000 people, surely someone would call you out on it. Surely that would be important. No one called them out. The only time they were ever called out publicly was when Madeleine Albright was asked, is it worth it that 500,000 children have lost their lives because of the sanctions in Iraq? And she said yes. Well, 500,000 children die, and that's acceptable? By what measure is that acceptable? Also, they stood by knowing full well what was going on in Rwanda and did nothing. They had one leaked story that was fake after another saying why it wasn't genocide, but it was. And then, of course, Hillary supported the National Defense Authorization Act in the second term. And also, they gave us the wrong information, fake stories on who was responsible for the meltdown. They made it seem as like it was the homeowner who shouldn't have signed liar's loans and shouldn't have bought anything that they couldn't afford. But not once did Hillary Clinton come forward and say, stop home foreclosures. After all, these are the same banks foreclosing that has given her millions and her foundation tens of millions. They mishandled the Arab Spring. Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, was on the side of the governments like Egypt and Bahrain and Yemen instead of with the students and those supporting an overthrow of the tyrants. She led the coup against Honduras, Libya, Paraguay, and she increased the National Security Agency spying on America. And also, when the CIA was caught spying on every member of Senate, shades of J. Edgar Hoover there, why weren't they called in on this and put on the carpet and fired? They weren't, not a single person. They also supported the executive assassinations and drone wars. Over 11 million people during her stay had left the workforce and are now unaccounted for. They put through the passage of TARP and other bailouts, but not of small businesses and not of individuals. And they had the Clash for Clunkers, which cost $1.4 million spent for every job it created. So you look at Obamacare, which she was a major supporter of, and then the national debt, and the greater militarization of local law enforcement and also foreign. Her idea was, you know, we don't need to negotiate. We don't need detente. We don't need peace. We're tough. And then she threatened the nuclear option in Iran and even putting more troops around Russia. Russia doesn't have any troops around anyone else. We do. So do you think that maybe there are a group of people in America who simply took the time to look at the research to see this is not someone who represents the best ideals for peace and harmony for the environment? Because all of her sponsors were also the major polluters. If you doubt me, show me one single thing that she did, or Obama, to stop pollution, where it wasn't voluntary, it was mandatory. Zero. Show me one thing she did to challenge Israel on its apartheid regime. Zero. So that would be some of the reasons that she didn't win. It had nothing to do with Russian spying. By the way, the Russians cannot hack into the Democratic National Convention. That came from a person inside who was disillusioned after he saw what they were doing to Bernie Sanders, who he supported. And he then met with a person in a field in Virginia, handed him a large box of the documents showing all this corruption. Those were given to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and those then were put back into the community. And when people started to realize how down and dirty it was and how that Bernie Sanders had been defeated unethically and would have been the candidate of choice and would have defeated Donald Trump. And, oh, by the way, that guy ended up being shot in the head shortly thereafter. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's now go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by. And we're going to take on a little different journey now. Let's just take a moment to say hello to Lewis Lapham. And I gave you his background a little earlier. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here.
In the coming Trump era, to make America great again and to reinforce this notion of the U.S.'s global exceptionalism that you have written about, we also might consider why American journalism, in my personal opinion, and I speak only for myself, is no longer great. We are still in the throes of the recent fake news controversy with the Washington Post, New York Times. There's clearly confusion about what is and what is not fake. And so often what mainstream media reports as being truthful turns out to be fake by their own admission. The most recent example of this actually concerns Syria. For years, since the Arab Spring, the Times and the Post and all the major networks have promulgated the myth that problems in Aleppo started with demonstrations. And this week, the Washington Post, which has been a voice of this and has been at the heart of this, now says, okay, it was also the Sunni Salafi groups and was never the scene of peaceful uprisings. So just like Trump, who obviously many Americans don't perceive as fake, or they wouldn't have voted for him, obnoxious, yes, narcissistic, yes, immature, yes, we are also confronted with this threat of fake news from all sides, including the mainstream media companies. So what is your take on the fake news controversy, and how did we get here, and does the mainstream media's retreat from journalistic integrity threaten our democracy?
Well, listen, I mean, you just told a story. It's been going on for a very long time. I mean, you want to take it back to the Wilson administration and the entire skeet spin of the fake news on, as to the our neutrality in World War One, and then the New York Times was printing. Wilson was trying to drum up support for America going into World War One, which was in the interest, by the way, of the banking establishments making a killing, supplying arms to Britain and France. But the New York Times is actually running stories saying that the Germans are 200 miles offshore New Jersey, prepared to land three divisions within 24 hours. That's that sort of thing. I mean, George Creel, who ran the propaganda ministry for Wilson. What we now know as the canon of great books was actually composed by the Creel propaganda office and imposed on Columbia University in order to give our troops some explain to them why they were fighting for Western civilization. And, you know, Charles Beard, one of the leading historians at Columbia, resigned. And so did Thorsten Veblen. I mean, I started out as a newspaper reporter in San Francisco in 1957. And fake news is what the corporate media does. I mean, that's their, mission is to inform the American people that their government is wise, that the laws are just, that our military is invincible, that we are the happiest, bravest, luckiest people on earth. That's the message. And wonderful example. I mean, you know, you called to talk about a book that I've written called Age of Folly, which is a sort of, it's a collection of my reporting over a period of 25 years, starting with the George H.W. Bush invasion of Iraq in 1991. Taking it down to the election of Trump. And it's a pretty straight line. I mean, people wanted to say that the election was in the good spirit of rough and tumble democracy and out of the usual media lies, some kind of truth had ascended, and it was a great victory. It was showing that our government of the people, by the people, and for the people had not perished from the earth. Well, that might have been the case if Sanders was on the ballot, but he wasn't, and neither was democracy. What was on the ballot was plutocracy. And you had, at the top, plutocracy complacently stupefied and transparently corrupt at the head of both the Democratic and the Republican ticket. I mean, you had, two gold-plated names on the same boardroom door. And the, both of them standing four square in true blue for the freedom of money and vigilant and steadfast against the freedom of movement and thought. Now, Hillary lost because she tried to pretend that she cared about something other than herself. And she was so bad at that pretense and was so obviously not true. She tried to sell the Lincoln Gettysburg Address and failed dismally. I mean, because just any knowledge of her record, which I would love to have a transcript, by the way, of your narrative that you produced, I listened to about the Clinton administration. And Clinton, I mean, the idea that Clinton's administration was somehow liberal and in favor of truth, justice, the Constitution, and the American people is a joke. But and it was all there. It was right there in plain sight. But the media, as you say, the mainstream media, the corporate media, is an advertisement for reality, and that's what it is. It's advertising, and you want to call that fake news, you call it fake news, but that's been the business of our mainstream media for as long as I can remember, and wait a minute, where was I? Okay, but Clinton, Louis Brandeis, the great Supreme Court justice at the beginning of the New Deal, says to Franklin Roosevelt, we must make our choice. We can have democracy or we can have a concentration of wealth in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. And Trump comes down the escalator on June 15th, 2016, deus ex machina, into the atrium of the Trump Hotel, and he's absolutely upfront and fascist, and says that Brandeis had it right. You can't have them both. And as far as he was concerned, democracy was a tip on a dead horse. That's his worldview. That was the same worldview of Alexander Hamilton and Ronald Reagan. That's all he said. He said, I'm really, really, really rich. And money, my friends, is power. And power is not self-sacrificing or democratic. And that's true, and that was the operative principle, power, not liberty, was the operative principle of the Reagan administration, of the Clinton administration, of the two Bush administrations, and of the Obama administration. And so, Trump he's just an extension of where he's been coming down the road for the last 25 years. Welcome home.
You observe, by looking over the last 25 years or so, a trajectory in American politics and culture that you can categorize as a national self-congratulatory attitude that fuels this myth of U.S. exceptionalism,
yeah.
The greatest and most powerful nation in the world, the gift bearers of democracy and liberty to the rest of the planet, and a lot of this is hubris. Therefore, if we can understand this arc, it should not be a surprise that Trump will enter the White House, and the American experiment in democracy is turning into a failure. So please go in further, beyond what you just did, into the detail of how our national self-congratulatory culture and how it strengthens anti-democratic politics. And second, can you tie this into the disease the ancient Greeks and yourself have written about, known as the pleonexia? This pleonexia is unknown in America today.
Unknown, my God. I mean, it's what we're suffering from, that disease, and we've been suffering from that disease for a long time, and most pronouncedly so with the election of Reagan. This is Aristotle. All government starts out, whatever name you give it, as oligarchy. It's always going to be a few arranging the distribution of wealth and justice to the many. I don't care. So everything starts out as some form of an oligarchy. And so did our government. I mean, that's what Benjamin Franklin called a republic, madam, if we can keep it. That's what he had in mind. That's what they had in mind in 1787 in Philadelphia. And an oligarchy only lasts as long and is as good as the people who manage it, you know. And Madison says that again in 1787. We want a government by people with the wisdom to discern and the virtue to pursue the common good of the society. And he counted himself and among the signatories of the Constitution. They regarded themselves as men with the wisdom to discern and the virtue to pursue. And they also, of course, were solidly on the side of money. I mean, they're all wealthy in one way or another. They don't use the same words that we do. I mean, property was what the original Declaration: life, liberty, and the pursuit of pursuit of property, not happiness. That was changed in the but as Aristotle also points out, all oligarchies over time become rancid, you know, and it's like cheese in the sun. Because they suffer from the disease that the Greeks defined as pleonexia, which is the insatiable appetite for more. More of anything, of everything. More dancing girls, more victories, more special effects, and so forth. And the belief that there is nothing that money can't buy. That's the disease. Aristotle discusses it, so does Plato. It's also the disease that eventually destroys the Roman Empire. The oligarchy becomes so selfish that it has contempt for the people or the poor, and that's just a matter of historical record. I mean, you can see it over time. You can see it happen in Greece. You can see it happen in Rome. You can see it happen in the Ancien Régime in France. It's not news. That is the disease to which the American ruling, governing, political class, oligarchy, succumbs. And Reagan is elected on the premise that I want America above all to be a country in which everybody can get very, very rich. But he doesn't mean everybody. He just means the people who happen to be in the right place or at the right time or have the the connections. Wealth is money is our civil religion, and people have been pointing this out for as long as the Republic has existed. I mean, this is Tocqueville talks about this, Whitman talks about this, Mark Twain talks about this, even Teddy Roosevelt talked about this. This is not new, and the corporate press, God, I mean, during the Gilded Age, they would go interview the Robert Barons, and they would sit there with their hats on their bowler hats on their knees, and then walk in and ask for a statement from the great man, and he'd drop, a sentence into their upturned hat. And it's, oh. I mean, I've been at one point I was on the White House press corps for the Saturday Evening Post. I was brevetted to the White House press corps during the Johnson administration for about 4 months. And I mean, they talk about fake news. I mean, the daily briefing, it's like dropping fish into the mouth of the seals in the zoo.
What we need to do, we need to continue this conversation for an hour on an upcoming program. So, Lewis, if you have an hour at some point in the near future, I'd like just to have you on for the hour to talk about this in a more extended conversation.
Yes, but can you send me that long thing you just, said about the Clintons?
I will be happy to. I'll send it out today.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lewis Lapham, Lapham, he's an American legend, is a historian and writer. And his new book is Age of Folly. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.